You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of August 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here at Monocle 24 in London with me, Andrew Tuck. Coming up on the programme, mass evictions of Roma from their camps in France are turning into a PR disaster for President Hollande. Why has he kept on with the harsh policies of Nicolas Sarkozy? We asked our man in Paris.
We can't do nothing. Previous attempts haven't worked. This dismantlement of camps gives off terribly bad publicity. It plays into the hands of all the opponents of François Hollande and his allies. And so what they're trying is this integration approach, making it easier for the Roma people to get jobs. Only 15,000 of them officially here in France. So it oughtn't really to be that difficult to make them integrate.
We'll also look at New Yorkers' love-hate relationship with cycling and ask why they can't always embrace their inner peddler. Monocle's Sophie Grove is on the road in Maputo, meeting the architects building Modern Mozambique. We'll catch up with her in a moment. And later in the show, we'll hear from the celebrated American journalist Mort Rosenblum about long-form writing.
I mean, when I started working for the Associated Press, I would say to them, okay, I think something's really important in Africa. I'm going to go spend, you know, maybe a couple of months and a lot of your money cruising around the Sahel and finding out what's going on. And we were able to do this huge, solid report 6 months before the Ethiopian famine to say what's actually going on. And it's important to be able to do that. It's very hard to do that these days.
And we'll open the trash can on America's bad food habit. The US now throws away 40% of what its shoppers buy. All that coming up in the next 60 minutes here on Midori House, live from London on Monocle 24. But first, let's catch up on the news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
At least 30 children have been injured today when a bus they were travelling in toppled near Ingolstadt. According to the Bavarian police, the driver seemed to have lost control of the bus during a sudden hailstorm near the town. The bus was taking children home from a holiday trip. There was no further information about the health situation of those injured children. A farmhand in South Africa, which has been jailed for life for the murder of the white supremacist Eugene Terre Blanche in April last year. Chris Malangu killed the 71-year-old with an axe over a pay dispute at his farm in Ventersdorp, which is 80 miles from Johannesburg. The judge said the attack had not been racially motivated. Crowds have gathered at the Prime Minister's palace in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa today to mourn their late leader Meles Zenawi. 57-year-old Zenawi died late on Monday, depriving Western powers of a trusty ally in the fight against Islamist militants in the Horn of Africa. Two German tourists and two Kenyan pilots have been killed when a plane carrying tourists crashed in Kenya's Masai Mara game reserve. Airstrip workers and locals rushed to the crash site and pulled seven survivors out of the mangled wreckage. Italy is today facing record temperatures for the year, with the thermometer reaching 40 degrees Celsius, that's 104 degrees Fahrenheit, in parts of the capital Rome. Experts said today was the hottest day of the year so far, with 11 cities across the country being put on alert. With little breeze and the stifling heat, tourists huddled into the few areas of shade to be found. And finally, an American who has an extraordinary range of 10 octaves has acquired the world record for hitting the lowest note. Tim Storm's talent was discovered after he sang at a Christian summer camp as a child, and it deepened even further when he reached adulthood.
Well, I sang with a Christian a cappella group several years ago, and at one of the concerts we did, there was an ear, nose and throat specialist. And after the concert, he said, "Man, I've got to see your vocal cords." I was like, "Okay." He's like, "Can you come to my office so I can look at your vocal cords?" I was like, "Sure, okay." So he stuck a video scope, up my nose and down my throat. And I could see my vocal cords on a video screen, which was really cool. Kind of gross, but really cool.
Here is an example of that singing voice.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound.
Amazing indeed, and those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jonathan. I think my voice is a little bit butcher than that, but...
Possibly.
Anyway, how can he compete with me? Anyway, it's 21.05 in Moscow, 18.05 in London, and 13.05 in New York. And you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Then a Monocle 24 podcast, yeah.
Monocle 24, yeah, you're also.
This is Monocle 24.
Tämä on Monocle 24. Dobro
pozdravljam. Monocle 24.
This is 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 Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
The Roma rarely find a welcoming committee when they turn up anywhere in Europe, but they might have been expecting a slight thawing of attitudes in France after the election of François Hollande as president. During the election campaign, Hollande had hit out at Nicolas Sarkozy's policies that had seen mass evictions and Roma encouraged to return to Romania and Bulgaria. In France, the images had triggered memories of wartime deportations. But the election of Hollande has done little to change the policy, and in recent days, Roma have once again been evicted with nowhere to go. Earlier, I spoke about the situation with our Paris correspondent, Tom Burgess-Watson, as he stood in front of the Pompidou Centre. I began by asking him to explain why he had chosen that particular spot.
I'm sitting in front of the Pompidou Centre in central Paris, an area called Beaubourg, a nice cafe just looking onto the back of the Pompidou Centre. And it's an area that's always jam-packed with tourists, and today is absolutely no exception. There are buskers, there are little stands with bits of amusement, people here to paint your portrait or your caricature. So it's a fun atmosphere. But what's not quite so fun for a lot of people that come here is that they leave with a very bad taste in their mouth after their holiday in Paris that they've dreamed of and saved up for, many of them. And it's a once-in-a-lifetime trip for so many people, and they get pickpocketed and they leave Paris with a very dim view of the city, because they leave without a passport, they have to get their credit cards all renewed. And what you have here, and I've seen quite a number of them already, these gangs of kids that go around, some of them pretending to be deaf, and they ask you to sign a petition, and whilst you're signing that, another one is rifling through your bag, or they'll pass you something and you have to pick it up and you have a look at it or whatever it is. Sometimes it's a gold ring and they say, do you want to buy this gold ring? I just found it on the floor. And you buy it off them thinking you've stumbled across a piece of treasure and that you've just got it for a song, because you give them 50 euros for what you think is worth 5,000 euros, and they're happy and you're happy. But it's all a series of scams, and I'm afraid it's the same people. It's these gangs who are living on the fringes of Paris. They're controlled by older figures, a bit like Fagin in Oliver Twist, really, who control these kids, and they're ideal for the job because they can't be prosecuted because they're minors.
Now, we don't want to kind of categorise a whole group of people as being involved in crime, but obviously many of the children you're talking about have come from Roma families who have come to France, mainly from Bulgaria and Romania. And currently there's roughly, I believe, like 15,000 of them in France. And they've become a bit of a political hot potato for President Hollande.
Absolutely. Today, in fact, Wednesday, the Prime Minister, Jean-Marc Ayrault, held a special meeting with all his ministers on what to do about these Roma camps, which are on the edges of all the major cities, Marseille, Lyon, and certainly here in Paris. When I drove out to the airport 2 weeks ago, before the crackdown began, before the dismantlement of a lot of these camps began, not for the first time, I should add, I was quite astonished, actually, at just the scale of the encampments. They were really vast encampments, as far as the eye could see in some directions, under bridges, on the motorway, in disused areas and warehouses. Very, very large indeed. Now, the government here in France can't ignore this. You know, you can't have a rule for one people that says it's okay for them to build a city, a makeshift town on the edge of other towns, and not for everyone else to be able to do the same. And of course, it's got French people's backs up in a fairly major way now, of all times, in fairly economically trying times. So what the Prime Minister has been doing at his meeting today is trying to find a solution. One of the ideas that was under discussion today was this possibility of providing legal status for many of the Roma people and giving them the same working rights that they haven't had actually up until now. Now there are 9 European countries at the moment that have restrictions on Romanian workers and Bulgarian workers. They need a special permit for their first 5 years in France. So the idea at that meeting today, one of the ideas that was put forward is, look, we can't do nothing. Previous attempts haven't worked. This dismantlement of camps gives off terribly bad publicity. It exactly plays into the hands of all the opponents of François Hollande and his allies. And so what they're trying is this integration approach, making it easier for the Roma people to get jobs. As you said, only 15,000 of them officially here in France. So it oughtn't really to be that difficult to make them integrate.
President Hollande, before he was elected, when he was on the campaign trail, he was very critical of Sarkozy's policy of dismantling these camps without having any plan of where those people could go. Yeah, he seems to be following exactly the same policy. Why is that?
Absolutely. I mean, it's in many people's eyes, and certainly in the eyes of the press and Team Sarkozy, it's even worse this time around because there's an element of great hypocrisy, as you mentioned. I mean, the left was very critical of the right back in 2010 when what was perceived as a massive PR blunder on Sarkozy's part when he first started dismantling. He dismantled about 70%. It was under his watch that 70% of Roma camps were dismantled. In so doing, Sarkozy upset Brussels, he upset the Vatican. France was put on a special EU watch list for this, and what they did was to give many of these Roma people a check or cash and put them on chartered flights back to Romania. But it was a lose-lose situation because not only was the French taxpayer paying for them to go overseas, but within a matter of weeks, almost all of them were coming back again. And there's a report in today's Le Monde, in fact, that tells the tale of a family that's made the journey to and from France one way by air, the return trip by air, and the outward journey by van or by car. And it's become something of a joke, really. I mean, it makes the politicians look like the laughing stock. And within the Socialist Party, considerable squabbling over what to do. The first secretary of the Socialist Party, Martine Aubry, she talked about these evictions and calling them regrettable, which is a fairly clear way of saying she doesn't agree with them. And the main argument against this current tactic is that there's been no alternative lodgings provided or offered to the people who are being displaced. And that was something that Hollande promised he would do when he was on the election campaign.
Finally, perhaps you could just tell us, you say this has been a bad PR for the president, but actually when you look at the opinion polls, 80% of people say that they agree that the camps should be dismantled. Is it just bad PR within his own party with the people on the left who feel that these images of people being deported are a bit reminiscent of images from France during the Second World War? Is that the only really the constituency that's upset with his behaviour?
I think the very sensitive historical past, the equating this with a sort of ethnic cleansing, if you like, that's what some people have called it, and then comes the hateful language where Sarkozy was accused, for example, of equating all Roma people to being criminals and saying that the camps were disease-ridden. So it was a disaster in PR terms for Sarkozy. It's so far been a disaster for Hollande. It seems that there's nothing that can be done to approach this in a successful way. But as you say, 80% of the general public in France are in agreement that dismantling these illegal camps is the right thing to do. But what's clear is that doing nothing is not an option. But exactly what should be done until now hasn't been agreed upon, and until now all that's been agreed on is how to move the problem rather than solve it.
Well, that was our man in Paris, Tom Burgess Watson, and you're listening to Midori House, and we'll be right back.
Thailand is the world's largest exporter of rice, shipping more grains abroad than any other nation. Perhaps even more surprisingly, we're also the world's leading producer of hard disk drives, powering global electronics. And we also make great music. So from sound bites to megabytes, you could say that we're making all the right noises. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
It's 18:15 here in London, 10:15 in Seattle, and you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Now, Manhattan is flat and easy to navigate, but somehow a cycling culture has never really taken hold. But a new survey says that New Yorkers have finally learnt to rather like cycle lanes, even if they don't actually use them very much. Meanwhile, plans for a Paris-style bike share scheme have failed to capture the public's imagination, which is a good thing because its launch has been delayed until next spring. Aisha Spears, our New York bureau chief, has donned her helmet and popped on her cycle clips to join us on the line now. Hello, Aisha.
Hello, how are you?
Very good, thank you. Now, first of all, this cycling culture idea. Why is it that New Yorkers kind of have this kind of on-off relationship with it? You know, some people obviously do embrace it, but it doesn't quite click as a cycling city in the way that you might imagine it would.
I think that, I mean, firstly, that before the Bloomberg administration, there really weren't bike lanes for people to cycle on. So now that there are more of those, I think there are more New Yorkers in favour of it. But the other two big issues are, firstly, I don't think a lot of people have space to store bicycles. So, there, you know, you have a walk-up apartment, you lug your bike up there, you don't want to bring a dirty bike into a tiny space. So perhaps there should be more bike storage. On the streets, they often just get nicked. And then I think another thing is there's not much of a cycle kind of proficiency test thing going on. So you've got a lot of people on these bike lanes who don't really know how to cycle. And that's where a lot of the complaints about the bike lanes come from.
Now, I was just referencing there this idea that there is going to be for New York a kind of a bike share scheme, but that's been delayed until next spring. Is that just because of the problems of the infrastructure, or again, is that trying to put in, you know, safety measures, proper cycling routes for people to get around the city?
The cycling routes are in place, the physical infrastructure is in place. Apparently what Bloomberg has said is that the software is not yet in place, and that's to do with Alta, who are the company who have been developing this bike sharing scheme. They're also the people behind the scheme in Montreal and in Washington, D.C. So it's more of a technical problem. A lot of people are very excited about the bike share scheme, especially for it to be in place this summer. So I think the fact that people have been quite disappointed shows that it will be popular when it eventually does launch.
Now, I met Mayor Bloomberg for the last issue of the magazine, and he was, you know, very confident about the changes that had been made to New York. And it is incredible the amount of green space that's been used. There are kind of more cycle routes. There's a greater emphasis on getting around, not by car and by using, you know, feet and bike. But do you think that part of the problem for New York and the cycle culture is just these kind of, you know, when you're coming down Broadway and there are trucks coming down, there's very little space to hide if you're a bicycle. It's not like in London where you feel that actually the traffic is slowed down by the kind of curves of the road.
Yeah, indeed, that's part of the problem. I think the grid isn't actually that safe for cyclists. So you've got the bike lanes, there are lots of greenways which are kind of up the middle of large roads which have little fences on either side of the bike lane. So you feel quite safe there, but then again, it's quite easy for you to hit a pedestrian, which happens, I guess, a little bit too often for most pedestrians. And a lot of the bike lanes don't go down the big roads like Broadway. And then if you are on those roads, the people who are cycling on them are either rather brave couriers or food delivery guys who often have mechanical engineered bikes which don't stop. So it's a kind of bad press for cyclists, for the people who do brave Broadway.
Can I ask you, do you ever cycle around the city?
I do, but I normally borrow a bike because I don't have space to put a bike in my apartment. So I do think that the main thing that could enable people to bike more would be able to park your bike somewhere safe and for not a very high price, and then more people would be biking.
Well, one of the things that you notice when you're near our office, you know, our office is on Broadway, almost in Soho, is that actually that part of the city, there are some good bike shops. There is a bit of a cycling culture there. But if you wanted to find a real cycling culture in New York City, would you have to go to Brooklyn? Would you have to come out of Manhattan, do you think?
Indeed. Well, I think a lot of people who live in Brooklyn will choose to commute into the city on a bicycle, and a lot of the bridges have very good bike lanes. But a lot of the uproar against bike lanes has come from the kind of stroller neighborhoods of Park Slope in Brooklyn, because they don't want, you know, bike lanes to get in the way of where they can drive their cars, because more people obviously use cars in Brooklyn. So I think that in the city, a lot of people do use bikes. There are a lot of bike shops now, and last weekend they closed down Park Avenue, and there are so many people on bicycles inside the city. So I think if it's made easier, more and more people will bike.
We were speaking on the briefing a few hours ago about Sydney, and there they have a similar issue. It's an amazing city, great quality of life, But there's a real kind of friction between the car owners and the cyclists. You know, they're still not quite sure who should own the streets. And in the CBD, there's an ongoing dispute about, you know, whether the cycle lanes are in the right place. You've been touching on it here. Why do you think that New Yorkers were so up in arms when the first cycle lanes went in?
I think because you've got the majority of New Yorkers are either going to be in a car or a taxi or walking. And I think both of those groups are threatened by bicycles for some reason. So I think the people in their cars think the roads are going to be taken up by bicycles. There's already a problem with traffic, especially within Manhattan. So why should we give up one lane of traffic for bicycles? And then pedestrians are just afraid of getting hit by a bicycle who's going down the street the wrong way, because we're, you know, most of the streets are on a one-way system. So I think that if people are better educated about how to cycle, it would also take away a lot of the complaints that people have.
Good. Well, we look forward to seeing you wobbling around on a bicycle at some point soon in Manhattan and beyond. Thank you very much, Aisha. That was Aisha Spears, who's Monocle's New York Bureau Chief. It's 21 minutes past the hour, and we'll be talking to our woman in Berlin in a moment. But first, let's stay on our cycling lane and have a listen to Bicycle by Memory Tapes. And that was Bicycle by Memory Tapes.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo.
Essa é a Monaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monaco 24. Hong Kong,
Zurich, London.
Londres. Esto es Monaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai a Monaco, 24.
From London.
In London.
London, Cara.
De Londres.
This is Monaco 24.
And you're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. It's a treacherous time to be a parent in Germany. Or one would think so, given what's been happening across the country during the past school year. If you're headed to warmer climes trying to escape with the kids before their official school holidays start, well, you might just be fined. In Bremen, you can be made to pay up to €35 a day, in Düsseldorf, €80. And in Hesse, each year, about 300 to 400 cases are brought against parents for such unexcused absences. So, what's going on here? We thought we'd ask our woman in Berlin, Kimberly Bradley. Hi, Kimberly. What is going on? Is this a new trend, or have German authorities always been really strict about when you can take your kids out of school?
It's actually been strict. This is the law was, it dates back to 1938. It's actually a bit of a Nazi law, where they were, the Third Reich was attempting to keep kids in school because people were leaving the country. I mean, that is to put it bluntly. Now the situation is more a matter of saving money on holidays because the airline prices jump on the day that the school is let out. So a lot of parents are attempting to save some money on holidays by taking their kids out 2-3 days earlier or coming back 2-3 days later. And this has been increasing in the past 3 years dramatically, apparently. And in recent years, they're having the police will show up at the airport. There have been a few cases that have been kind of dramatic.
And we're talking about these cases where there has literally been a police officer who swooped on families about to depart for their sunny holiday, demanding to know, you know, why their child isn't in school. Do these stories kind of, when they're covered in the press, is the press saying, actually, this is a good thing? Or on the whole, are people thinking that actually the rules need to be relaxed a little bit these days?
The statistic, there was a survey done a couple of years ago, and 60% of the parents think that these rules are too strict. Of course, the students think 88% of the kids think they're too strict. But a lot of people, there have been some German families, honestly, in doing some research just on this question today, because this is in the news today, as schools begin again, kids are coming back late. There have been a number of families that have left the country because it's not even a matter of coming in and out of school. It's illegal to homeschool your kids. The strictness goes a little further. So some families are just fed up. They go to France. They go to the U.S. What isn't happening is you're not really seeing a protest movement. You know, on the other side, there are plenty of families that just adhere to the rules and realize, okay, my child has to be in school. We'll be back on this day. You know, that's the end of it.
And Kimberly, can I ask you, amongst your friends in Berlin, you know, are they actually all abiding by the rules? Or do you notice amongst your friends that people are actually beginning to sneak their kids out of school here and there?
Most actually abide. Some of the foreigners go to private schools, and they're a little bit more lenient. The private schools, they sometimes have slightly different holiday days. And being that I'm an expat, I kind of probably have a higher percentage of friends who send their kids to private bilingual schools. But I've been warned. I have a small child. She's three. And in the German kindergarten system, you can come and go as you please, and I travel a lot. And we've been warned, this will end in 3 years. And I'm kind of worried about it. I'm considering my own options. It's a tricky question. Also, if you choose to do something a little off the norm, it's a bit difficult here because of these old laws.
And you know, just touching on that, you know, it does seem that the school system is incredibly rigid in Germany. Even you know, in some states, I know there's still kind of rules and regulations about what you can call your children before they go to school. You know, people are very strict about the names that are allowed to be registered. Do you find that the school system for the kids that you know is a bit too disciplined in everything they do, or is this just the one area where they seem to be having such harsh controls?
In that case, I think it really depends on the school. They're strict with times. They're strict with... in the southern part of the country, I know that the instruction is actually stricter than it is up here in Berlin. It depends so much on the city that you're in and the particular school that you send your child to. I don't think you can really generalize that. One other issue that I'm forgetting to mention is that the parents who take their kids in and out of school early and late, there's some teachers who also kind of stop teaching seriously about a week before or the first week that the kids come back and they take their kids out for ice cream. That's a situation that's also being discussed. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how this evolves in the next few years, simply because, it's increasing. I think parents are wanting to make their own decisions and also wanting to take decent holidays instead of being restricted.
It's not very nice banning ice creams anyway.
No.
Kimberly, thank you very much for coming on to speak to us. That's Kimberly Bradley, who's Monocle's Berlin correspondent. And now it's time for the news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Thanks very much. At least 30 people in Germany have been injured today when a bus they were travelling in toppled over near Ingolstadt. According to Bavarian police, the driver seemed to have lost control of the bus during a sudden hailstorm near the town. A farmhand in South Africa has been jailed for life for the murder of the white supremacist Eugene Terblanche in April last year. Chris Malango killed the 71-year-old with an axe over a pay dispute at his farm in Ventersdorp. The judge said the attack had not been racially motivated. Crowds have gathered at the Prime Minister's palace in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa today to mourn their late leader Meles Zenawi, who died late on Monday, depriving Western powers of a trusty ally in the fight against Islamist militants in the Horn of Africa. Two German tourists and two Kenyan pilots have been killed when a plane carrying tourists crashed in Kenya's Masai Mara game reserve. Airstrip workers and locals rushed to the crash scene and pulled seven survivors out of the mangled wreckage. Italy is today facing record temperatures for the year, with a thermometer reaching 40 Celsius, 101 Fahrenheit, in parts of the capital Rome. Experts said today was the hottest day of the year so far, with 11 cities across the country being put on alert. And those are the stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Jonathan. Now, it's hardly news that journalism is in trouble. Papers are closing, magazines are shrinking, unless you work for Monocle, and we're all on our smartphones. Well, some people are. But long-form journalism, proper investigative pieces stretching into tens of thousands of words, isn't dead. In many ways, it's thriving. Mort Rosenblum has covered stories on seven continents since the 1960s. He was editor of the International Herald Tribune and has been bureau chief of Associated Press pretty much everywhere they have a bureau. His most recent project, though, Looting the Seas, was funded by the International Consortium of International Journalists. Mort was joined by our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield a little earlier, and he started by asking if innovative long-term projects are creating a golden age for long-form journalism.
Well, you know, we're at the turn where it could go either way. I mean, the idea that there is funding for it, the idea that people are really interested, the reaction you get to a good, well-reported long-form piece is really encouraging, and it's really good. The problem is that in order to do a piece like that, you pretty much have to know what you're going to find before you find it, because you've got to raise the money. So you've got to go to your funders. You've got to go to, I mean, now you've got a thing called Kickstart where you can Kickstart. You can go online and get public subscription, but you've got to tell your story to get the money. So essentially all you're doing is going out and proving an hypothesis, which is not the same thing as reporting. I mean, reporting is going out into the jungle and poking around and following a trail and finding something you don't know about.
And do you think that, I mean, obviously there seems to be less money for the finding stuff out and poking around than there certainly used to be. I mean, there's less correspondence on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, you need this. Newspapers have to do this and magazines and stuff. And you have to, I mean, when I started working for the Associated Press back in 1841, you know, we had this huge staff and they gave me this job essentially. Actually, since 1981, I had this, my position was essentially special correspondent. I would say to them, okay, I think something's really important in Africa. I think there's going to be this really huge drought. I'm going to go spend, you know, maybe a couple of months and a lot of your money cruising around the Sahel and finding out what's going on. And we were able to do this huge solid report 6 months before the Ethiopian famine to say what's actually going on. Mm. That's important. It's important to be able to do that. And it's very hard to do that these days.
Let's talk about Looting the Seas, your latest project. Sum it up if you can.
Well, okay, we're running out of fish. The oceans are dying, essentially, in a couple of words. We all know that we're running out of fish. We all know that the oceans are in serious trouble. But when you start looking at the real causes, they're not ecological, they're not biological, they're not about fish, they're about people, they're about countries, they're about greed, they're about stupidity, they're about competition. And so I was fortunate enough to come across this really great investigative reporters that work with the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, and it's they've got quite good integrity, and they're very careful about the funds they use. And I had a very strong team of reporters, and we were able to focus on this fish called Jack Mackerel, which is in the Southern Pacific. It's complicated, but the short version is, it's the last buffalo. It's once we push that off the cliff, we're into the Antarctica pulling up krill. I've decided now to do a book and just really kind of devote my reporting life for the next year or two to finding out what it is, why we're overfishing so badly, why we're doing these things. And I'm coming up with a lot of answers already, and they're really hair-raising.
And it's the sort of story that if you were to try and do it in a traditional way through journalism, it kind of isn't really done by newspapers or magazines so much these days.
You really couldn't do it. I mean, you'd have to say to an editor, I'll call you in about 6 months. And by the way, here's my bank account. Put a big check in it. You
know, that doesn't happen so much these days.
You could do that before, but I wouldn't try that today.
That was journalist Mort Rosenblum with our Steve Bloomfield. Steve and Mort were also joined by Dan Hancocks, the author of Utopia and the Valley of Tears, A Journey Through the Spanish Crisis, a piece of long-form narrative journalism that details his trip to Marina Leda, a little-known communist town in Andalusia, led by charismatic poet-rebel Juan Manuel Sánchez Gordillo.
You're both doing long-form journalism. The book is, what, 40, 50,000 words?
It's 30, which is
30.
An unusual, yeah, sort of 30,000, that is, which is, you know, the kind of length that would be either a very short book or an incredibly long article. I mean, one that, you know, you would not find a space for sort of publishing in any regular magazine or newspaper, which is a liberating aspect of digital publishing, I think.
But the good thing, which was blindingly clear in the little short chat we had out as we were coming in here, is how much you've picked up in this short amount of time and how much knowledge you have of the subject and how you're able to get that across, mm-hmm. and whether you choose to do that in 30,000 words or 141 characters is important.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's great to say some guy's dead or, you know, to be able to announce the news, you know, but, you know, why, who, what are the forces, what next? And that's why it's so important what you're doing.
Yeah. I mean, I do hope that digital publishing will offer more opportunities like this for long-form journalism, because it's something that we are seeing kind of inevitably sort of cuts from sort of most broadsheet papers. I mean, there are also digital magazines which are sort of affording opportunities for this as well. There are places like the New Inquiry, which I think, if I can dare mention, rivals.
You can't. No, that's fine. We're fine with promoting journalism in all its forms. I mean, there's a number of these digital publishers now. You wrote one of the first Random House digital shorts, Brainshots.
Yeah.
Last year, you've got others like Byliner that are starting to offer these alternatives. As a journalist that wants to tackle a major issue and isn't going to be able, as Mort alluded to just before, sort of say to a magazine editor, I'll see you in 6 months, put a big check in my account. do you see these as real opportunities to do the sort of journalism you want to do that maybe 10 years ago wouldn't have been available?
I mean, they are, because you've got an outlet at the end of it which you have a lot of control over, obviously. I mean, it's been important for me to sort of continue to work with other trained professionals in sort of terms of editing and proofing and stuff. Unfortunately, I have the contacts to do that. I think if you isolate a journalist entirely from the institutions of publishing, because I've self-published this ebook because I've sort of having worked with Random House on the last one as an experiment, I thought I'd sort of see how this would work going solo, and it's doing very well.
Well, so far, yes, your sales are above Hitchens, I believe, in the top 10 right. of political books.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. Sorry, Hitch.
That was the author Dan Hancocks with Mort Rosenblum and our very own Steve Bloomfield. Dan's book is Utopia and the Valley of Tears, A Journey Through the Spanish Crisis, and it's out right now on Kindle. We'll be right back.
Thailand's famous hospitality is ingrained in our culture. From the warmest of welcomes to our culinary skill. That's why hospitality businesses like the world's best cooking school, Le Cordon Bleu, come to Thailand to sample our unique mix of exquisite cuisine and transcendent service. And all this against a soundtrack of fantastic homemade music. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
In the latest edition of The Entrepreneurs, we'll be looking at the market for Baltic bicycles in the UK, we'll be meeting one of the pioneers of Hong Kong independent retail, and we'll be finding out what high-tech startups can learn from century-old corporations.
We've got very, very strong partners in ABB and our manufacturing partners, so we'll be using that to get our global footprint and our foundation in place over the next 12 to 18 months to scale beyond that.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
We're going to have some music now, and this band's name celebrates everything that Mort Rosenblum is opposed to. It's called Cut Copy, and this is their track, Need You Now. And that was the sound of Cut Copy and Need You Now. Now, to Monocle, I have the nice job of being the editor, and I have a kind of electronic tagging system going where I kind of can track down any of our editors whenever I want, and especially if they're called Sophie Grove. Sophie Grove is our senior editor, and she managed to wangle a ticket to Mozambique out of me earlier this week, and she flew off to Maputo, but I want to know what she's up to. And luckily, we have her on the line. Hello, Sophie.
Hello, Andrew.
Now, what are you doing in Mozambique? I kind of know, but tell me.
So, I'm on the trail of architects and architecture here. It's absolutely incredible. It's kind of easy in a way because there's so much of it. So I started really with sort of Art Deco era. The Portuguese were here from early on in the sort of 16th century, really. But they really got going in the 1920s. In Maputo, and they just built these incredible villas all over the city, these natty little Art Deco apartment blocks and hotels where they were having a
really a gay old time, as they probably would have said, probably, and amazing terraces and cocktails and the kind of Belle Epoque life that you might expect, and theatres and incredible details, which is all sort of still here and preserved. And then I sort of looking at sort of 50s era, and there's an amazing Portuguese architect that was born in Porto, but then emigrated here when he was 7 with his family, and then he sort of building crazy international style, sort of inspired by Corbusier, Gaudi, Frank Lloyd Wright, kind of a hybrid of all of them at some points, and he built all over the city. So there's this incredible wealth of detail, and I've been on about 3 or 4 different architectural tours with, you know, different enthusiasts, architects, students. So it's just incredible.
I'm bringing up to date with the modern city. We've talked in the past about how many of the kind of former Portuguese colonies are doing incredibly well. So if you go to Angola, Luanda is a boom town. Is that that sense of kind of newfound wealth as well in Maputo?
There certainly is. I mean, it's packed with Portuguese people, which doesn't necessarily mean that there's newfound wealth in the sense that, you know, so many of them are coming from a pretty shoddy economy back home. But I was speaking to an economist today who said that, you know, Mozambique is projected to triple its GDP in 10 years. So there's an incredible sense of growth. I mean, Brazilian investors are here, Portuguese investors are here. I mean, the common language helps. But there's amazing amounts of resources. Nothing like you'd see in Angola. I mean, if you compare this place to Angola, I mean, you can't even begin. It's kind of sleepy. It's beautiful. It's leafy. It's calm. And there definitely isn't that feeling of frenetic madness. And one of the most brilliant things about it, I mean, there is quite a lot of Chinese presence, and there are some sort of Dubai-style towers springing up. There genuinely is a sense of buildings that are beautiful. They have some lineage to this heritage I just talked about. Their architect, their sort of national architect, is a man called Jose Forges, and he's sort of really a socialist kind of product of the liberation and product of you know, the war and Frelimo, the power that now governs here. But he still builds, and he's, you know, he's still an idealist. He's still a Marxist, really, but he's still building these incredible structures, and they're beautiful. So it isn't, there is boom and there is a lot of construction going on, like in other African cities, but it isn't at all, completely terrible and sort of, governed just by sort of who can throw up a tower as quickly as possible.
Now, obviously, some years ago, Mozambique had a long and divisive and cruel civil war. Is that feeling of a country that had been torn apart all vanished now as this kind of boom takes off?
Well, interestingly, Maputo wasn't really hit by the civil war in terms of its infrastructure, in terms of its buildings. There is a sense of a country having suffered a lot. I mean, everyone talks about the time where, you know, all the rations came from Russia. People were completely starving, really. There was something like 1 kilogram of rice per person per month. And, people talk about those times, you know, with so much pain and almost sort of, you know, they can't face talking about it. And the other thing is, you know, that the civil war was completely supported by South Africa, and people have this kind of feeling that, they feel very patriotic and that they don't want to sort of turn into South Africa. And there's so many South Africans here that it seems to be a bit of animosity there. But there isn't really a sense of a war-torn country that I have felt. I've been here for a week. And it feels like a country that's healed in this area. But people keep saying that the war was a guerrilla war fought in the jungle, in the hills, and it almost stopped at the kind of boundary of Maputo. There are some targeted attempts on ANC people who were here, sort of sheltering in safe houses. And there are definitely a few bombs dropped, but really limited when you think about how absolutely battered and bruised some cities are that have sustained a civil war for 16 years.
Well, Sophie, I'm really looking forward to reading your report, which is for Monocle, when you get back. And if you could do us a favour, if you could pop into a CD store in Maputo, because we don't have that much Mozambican music, it turns out, on the schedule. So I'm afraid there's a song coming up, but it has nothing to do with Mozambique or Sophie Grove or being in a nice reporting destination at all. But thank you for joining us. Go shopping for us. Good. That was Sophie Grove, who's our senior editor at Monocle. And keeping my promises, this is a song that has absolutely nothing to do with Mozambique. This is Reunion by M83. And that was Reunion by M83. A new report claims Americans now throw away 40% of all the food that they buy, or $165 billion worth of provisions every year. That means that the average US family bins $2,275 of food every year. What are the reasons for the failure to eat what they buy, and what can be done to stop it? Joining us now is Dana Gunders from the Natural Resources Defence Council, a project scientist in the Food and Agricultural Programme. Dana, thank you very much for joining us. These figures are truly horrifying. What is behind this kind of ever-escalating amount of food that's being thrown away?
Well, you know, we live in a time of such abundance of food in some ways, and yet for some people that's not true at all. But in the U.S., we have most of the population who just buys more than they eat, and it's not on their radar that this is an important thing that they should be addressing in their own personal lives, nor that they're losing money towards it.
And, you say there's a time of abundance. Do you think that food is perhaps too cheap if we treat it in this way?
Well, I do think that for many people, food is a small portion of their budget, and therefore they don't necessarily pay attention to the cost of throwing it out. But it's also just something that has really not been a focus of attention. And I think if people were to start paying attention, they'd realize actually they are throwing out quite a bit of money.
Now, apart from wasting money, what are the reasons why this is a really bad thing to be happening?
Well, farming and growing food takes a tremendous amount of resources. In the U.S., over half the land here is dedicated to agriculture and about 80% of our freshwater use. So when you kind of do the back of the envelope calculation, if we're not eating 40% of that food, that's something like a quarter of our fresh water that's going towards food that never gets eaten. And particularly here in the U.S., we're in a severe drought, and we're looking at rising food prices. So it's really an opportune time for us to start taking a look.
Now, I know in the U.K., for example, there's been a campaign to change the sell-by dates on food because there's a feeling that actually they're just too short and actually food lasts much longer than people imagine. I wonder, is this an issue in the U.S. as well? Do you think that people throw away a lot of food because they think that it's gone off, but in fact it's still fresh?
I do think it's absolutely an issue. There's quite a bit of that going on. The U.K. is so far ahead of the U.S., both on the expiration date issue and on food waste in general. So we don't even have good information about how much food gets thrown out because of dates. But, I know just from my own personal experience that many people I know throw things out right on the date. And here in the U.S., they're not even meant to indicate safety, but just rather that the food is at its best quality until that date.
And what happens to this food when it is thrown out? Does much of it go, you know, back into the is it used in agriculture, or is it literally ending up in landfill?
Believe it or not, only 3% of all the food that's getting thrown out is ending up in composting. Everything else is going to landfill. And food is actually the number one product in landfills today. It makes up the largest source of product in landfills and is causing almost a quarter of all the methane emissions in the U.S., which is a powerful greenhouse gas.
And tell me, your report, has it had traction with people in the food industry? Are the big food companies beginning to listen to you? Are the supermarkets concerned? Or is it one of these things where it's you know, the traditional lobby groups who have kind of seized on your report, but actually it's hard to get through to the kind of the people who can really influence what happens on a day-to-day basis?
Well, you know, the report just came out yesterday, so we have yet to see what the results will be. You know, the industry has followed the lead of the UK, where retailers and manufacturers have gotten together to begin a food waste reduction initiative. Right now, they're really just looking at diverting food from landfills and increasing donations. So they're not trying to address it at the source, and they're not looking at the consumer level and how they can help reduce waste there. But I do think it is a good start.
Well, Dana, thank you very much for joining us. That was Dana Gunders from the Natural Resources Defense Council.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Добро пожаловать, Monocle 24.
Esse é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, that's all for this edition of Midori House. The producer was Daniel Giacopelli, the researcher was Fernando Agosto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Ben Jay. Stay tuned, because up next after the news is this week's brand new episode of The Entrepreneurs. Emma Nilsson and Tamsin Smith will be back with Monocle Daily 3 hours from now. That's at 2200 hours London time. But for now, from all of us here at Midori House, it's time to say goodbye.